Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are adding some sophistication to the skills of human beings out there trying to deal with symbols. I don't know. That's a very convoluted definition, which I think is kind of perfect for it's supposed to be rhetoric. I am Dr. Dan, a former professor, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, and I interview people on this podcast to help us figure out some new ideas about dealing with what I would consider to be new rhetoric, or at least a new rhetoric environment. And I talk to comedians about their politics, always fun. I convert people that I think are slipping off the edges of safety in America, usually the right. And I talk to persuasion
the ideological pros. Safety net.
Yes, they're right. Yeah. So, And I love to talk to academics and rhetoricians, and that's what I'm doing today with my buddy Dave Payne. And we were going to do something else, but then we started talking about this, and so I'm dragging it in, and we're going to do an episode on it. Like, what is the state of rhetoric in the world right now? How do we show everybody? I did a tweet today that said, hey, by the way, if everybody just got really good rhetoric training, it would cure all the political troubles in America.
You're an idealist. But.
Well, I know it, but that's fine. We're just dealing with symbols, so I can be as idealistic as I want. There's nothing on the line. But I'm actively trying to create a rhetoric think tank, some type of, you know, Teach America Rhetoric Foundation to do this, to clean up public talk. The idea of sort of lowering the unethical persuasion, raising the ethical persuasion by getting everybody trained up. So what do you think about this, Dr. Dave Payne, who was just saying, like, people from Yale don't respect rhetoric?
Just a recent anecdote forwarded to me by my erstwhile spouse the other day was a linguist says that giving speeches is good for you.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That you might learn things in command of language. I don't know. I didn't read it because I just sort of had to shake my head with weariness. And she likened it to, since her field is performance studies, the phenomenon wherein every now and then an English teacher discovers that reading things out loud gives students a better understanding.
How can it be?
It's really akin to this, right? Oh, actually performing language an embodied speech might actually be a good linguistic thing to do.
Well, I have two questions to start this off. Number one, doing rhetoric for rhetoric, like somebody needs to do clearly rhetoric for rhetoric. It's not known, it's not understood, it's not used, it's not employed, and it's the field that de facto studies the management of messages in public. And so we need rhetoric for rhetoric. And secondly, is this because we're just a bunch of nerds who just like to sit around with the words and the text themselves and doing criticism and theory, as opposed to getting out and actually trying to crush this stuff and bulldoze it into the world? What happened? How did we get this low on the totem pole?
Boy, it's really this is something I've spent a considerable time thinking about over the years. And there's two sides to this, at least. It's sort of like in advertising, right? When they sell advertising, they really sell their theory of advertising. And there's all kinds of folklorish theories. It's symbolic, nuclear, whatever. Because they're always aggrandizing the thing itself, right? And so in a way, this has really nothing to do with how is this stuff actually operate. In other words, there's a gap between how we sell this, how we market it, and how it actually works. And rhetoric as a discipline kind of lives between those two. So part of what we have is in the history of talk about rhetoric is an attempt to make it an academically dignified thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so it attaches itself to all kinds of idealisms and structures that really have very little to do, or not, do not necessarily have anything to do with a description of how it actually works. And so I think that's part of the problem there. And all of that sort of occurs under the intellectual umbrella of, well, Plato said this is really bad stuff. And since we know Plato's really good stuff.
Plato, how he disparaged.
Well, it's really not a very good reading of Plato either.
Right. I agree. But he stained the sophist and it's lasted for 2,500 years. How did that happen?
Well, I think it is once again this sort of idealism about truth and certainty, and that mutates into science. If you go back, and there really is a kind of a relevant thing here that a lot of this has to do with the kind of the cusp between orality and literacy. And Plato was, part of his attack historically on the sophists was because the rival academy in Greece was Isocrates, who claimed to teach writing, or taught writing.
Right.
And so a lot of, you know, in the Plato's really defending the oral tradition over and against this. And so today, a lot of people think about rhetoric as simply the rules of writing, even though they might call themselves back to Aristotle's rhetoric as a significant, you know, they don't realize that that was not, that was the summation of an oral culture and the technology of rhetoric, not the rules of composition. Nonetheless, if you go around and interview people today about what they think, academics, what they think rhetoric is, it is largely wordsmithing or just simply, you know, good hygiene on the written word, right? So this the spirit that Plato actually well embodies when he's being not, you know, even the greatest sophist, the great argument would be that he's really the greatest of the sophist tradition. And that he's just really putting down these rivals who have their own, you know, arguably lesser theories, quite more questionable theories. So anyway, without reviewing that whole thing, that spirit of the oral is what is largely lost in the decline of rhetoric as an academic discipline, and the fact that it's, you know, it really isn't a discipline in the same sense. Or in other words, it never really was a very good example of this sort of foundational idea that we have certain, you know, certain knowledge or methods that we then base other things upon. Because it follows language and politics and the events around.
So but really it's also like to me, where I've constantly been thrown out of like the academic tradition, is to me rhetoric is like the hovercraft above all of it, you know, and it's got lasers, and if it wants to, it just starts picking off these other fields right and left, because it always has the deconstructive power to go back, at least theoretically, underneath language and the structures of language and the grammar of language, to show that here are the systems that are running your systems, right?
Well, it gets back to people, whatever this talk about knowledge and, you know, certainty and science and method, that really people are acting with with a purpose of impacting their worlds, and that they're, you know, and postmodern thinking kind of came around to basically, yeah, it's really all rhetoric. And once you get behind these kinds of language structures, of it is that doing of language in these particular historical kinds of contexts that gets reinvented anew in each new historical context. And that's the other problem is, just like we continue to come up with newer and better ways of talking about advertising, selling it to someone, we can do rhetoric without the dragging around the traditional language or categories of Aristotle or, you know, any of these people before, right? We don't need that language. And so it really is born, and this is, you know, this can either be seen as a good thing, that is, it's exfoliated into all of these other kinds of enterprise, so that there is a rhetoric going on in advertising. There is a rhetoric being fostered in education. There is a rhetoric, you know, there is more than ever before attention to the production and the doing of language in virtually every one of our enterprises. And so if you think about, you know, journalism has for in a great way mutated into editorial commentary and analysis. And a large part of that is rhetorical analysis, or as you were opining when we launched into this, that look at the right wingers. They've got all these think tanks that are coming up with what? How to make something happen by talking about it in certain kinds of ways. And if you start peeling back the, you know, 20-year long effort for getting the Supreme Court to be looking like it's starting to look like, you're going to see that there is a rhetorical map, a plan there. So, you know, sensitivity to the idea that how we talk about phenomena in the world is significant. And it's more and more true because we're grounded in the mediated flow of experience rather than, you know, checking the truth of that against real material circumstances, or so it seems, at least.
No, I think that's right. I think this idea of, you know, grounded in the flow of rhetorics, right? As I sometimes describe it, like you're born into the storm. It's not like you know, the best you can maybe do is an umbrella. You know, you're not able to just extract yourself as, you know, the meteorologist and watch the storm, especially because nobody's trained in the meteorology of symbolics. You know, they're shoving you right in, even the journalists, they're being shoved right into the hurricane, and then they're trying to comment on the hurricane.
Right. When we can do it in the studio, just leaning into the wind.
But that's, to me, like that as a metaphor, you know, a useful story metaphor for explaining to people what happens when you're born into these very coherent, you know, storms that have been formed over centuries, a lot of times across cultures, sure. And you are suddenly in it. Like rhetoric, I remember being extracted from the storm. And we talked about this, like when I first met you in grad school and started taking classes in this, it's almost like that carnival arm, you know, comes down, just lifts people up every once in a while. The arm of rhetoric goes, hey, there's stuff, come over here, you know, and then you start looking at it and going, oh my God, look at all these pockets of symbolic storming. And once you get to that point, you know, maybe it is this kind of postmodern relativism, but it's also this sense of empowerment. And this is what has frustrated me about rhetoric. Like you get pulled back and you're like a general looking at the board. But academics and rhetoricians don't seem to want to actually get into the fray.
Well, that's interesting. I think partially because of the urge to make it more, you know, to find an academic, you know, and what does the word academic really mean without purpose, right? Something that isn't a slave to all of these purposes out there, right? And so to find a place to comment that has some objectivity and some distance and is more generalizable. So, you know, it's easy to understand this urge for the one rhetoric to rule them all, right? But that flies in the face of your carnival crane metaphor.
Well, but the crane, the arm itself is the rhetoric.
It keeps trying to grab onto things and losing the grip.
Yeah, I mean, this idea that you can have a distance outside of your linguistic systems to look at your linguistic systems. And, you know, I've been working some of this stuff into stand-up lately, and just this idea of explaining to people the theory of language primacy, right? That language precedes reality, or at least interrupts reality so strongly, sure, that you might as well just dump the idea of reality because you're never going to get to it. Language is stuck on everything. And if you can get people kind of there, like, and they get some intuitive understanding of that, and you can keep it from flying off into the matrix as a, you know, film simulation, if you can get them there intellectually, then you can start to say, just because it's language as a primacy, there are ways rhetoricians have worked out to try to go into those storms and do some wizardry on the storm. Like there are some controls, things that you can do. You don't have to just take the fact that the right is structured. And we talked about this coming on. There's a big balloon of money on top of the right wing infrastructure. It's dumping down into think tanks, which are building communication, which are going into right wing media and political groups. So it's a very organized rhetorical system. And I think rhetoric would be like, yeah, that makes sense. The left hasn't set that up. And part of my thing is like, hey, if we really believe the right is dangerous to democracy and all the things that you don't want, you better set up a rhetoric infrastructure on your side, because this one's not going to stop churning out stuff. And it churns out very effective rhetoric because it's organized.
That moment in a number of ways in our conversation, that one, the left largely is at a disadvantage because it doesn't want to be playing that game. In other words, their idealism is, can we stop doing that? And so they do. Every time we win an election, we stop. Whereas that's when the right goes to work and says, oh, we can get the next one, right? And they do.
Why is it, again, like, it's part of this thing of, you were saying, sort of the staining of rhetoric as an activity, that being super organized and hyper conscious and intentional about how you create messaging, even from the top down, somehow is an immoral activity that's unethical. Why did we get to that point?
Right.
Like, to me, that's just creating good communication.
Right. And to the extent that rhetoric retains that sense of, that we were talking about, the applied non-academic sense of oral performance and persuasion, it is seen with disdain, right? That to call it rhetoric is generally to say, this is merely that, this is something, this is only a language strategy without substance, or, you know, it's to be suspect. So, you know, I think rhetoric can play the role as a term for a general term for the kinds of concerns that you're talking about, because it does have this sort of history that sort of says, gee, ever since societies have been doing this, and it has some campmates that it comes along with, open society, open systems, democracy, citizens being educated and trained to, right, so upward mobility, and ethical relativism. I think you start digging back, interest in rhetoric rises at times when there's an influx of different cultures, and meanings are not, you know, absolutely clear, when there's a certain kind of moral ambiguity or competition that, you know, decisions have to be wrought either in the court or in the public marketplace or through the competition of points of view. And there are different times in history where that's true. And every time they sort of rediscover this thing, right?
Every time there's chaos or crisis, they're like, oh, maybe we should get our act together and actually organize our messaging.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I just don't
see.
Well,
I do think there is a general awareness more than ever before that you've got to get your activity together and organize your messaging. And I think that once again, the technologies of rhetoric, the way of thinking about it, are lodged in any number of kinds of activities that simply don't go by that name. Right?
Right. But if they don't go by that name, they're not using all the tools that we've developed. They're not using the theory and the strategy banks and the tactic banks, all these things that, you know, I've spent a lot of time collecting to try to teach people that if you actually look at the history of rhetoric and all the things that it's developed, it's got, in some ways, I think of this as like one of the science fiction tropes of the ancients left us a weapon for situations just like this. Like in Game of Thrones, it was the academic, you know, the Tarly, who went and discovered that, oh, look at this, the ancients left us dragon glass, and he found it in a book. And this idea that the Greeks basically left us the instruction, don't try to run a democracy without a great understanding of rhetoric, because it's going to get pulled out from underneath you. And I think even Franklin said this, right, once they finished the, you know, the Declaration and the Constitution. It's like, well, you've got a republic, good luck keeping it.
Sure.
So I think rhetoric to me is always.
Well, I just mean that is one of the resistances, is that when people are impassioned in making sacrifice and threats or whatever to when they're invested with purpose, let's put it that way. That I think that's that one of the differences between the true believer and the dispassionate. Gee, I just want things to be normal, right? The reformers.
Well, yeah, everybody wants out of the war. I totally get it, but the war is on, but only one side is fighting it.
But once again, when you're invested in that truth, you don't want it called rhetoric. I mean, you know, in a way, you don't have to tell, you know, you don't have to tell the lefties, oh, that's just rhetoric over here. You understand that something's making these people jump around differently than they did 10 years ago. What is it? How did the Tea Party concerned with, you know, just as passionately, just as desperately, just as sure the world's coming to an end because of national debt, with the same people walking around in the street, how did they come 10 years later to, you know, spend all the money that, you know, on borrowed money and still have the same fervency and desperation? You know, in other words, we changed our clothing, but we're still living in, you know, so there still is a desperate truth here. It's not easy to tell the critics of that this is rhetoric, or to note the hypocrisies or ironies and in that. But you can't tell those people because they found an accommodating or an energizing truth at the same time, right? Where is that place to stand? And to say, well, the people on the left are not engaging in that is, of course, absurd. You're saying engage in it, but engage in it better.
Well, yeah, I'm saying they're fighting a soft war. Like, sure. Like this is not a soft war anymore. Symbolically, this is a hard war. You've got one side that's done everything a military does, which is get super organized, train everybody, give them weapons, and then continually fire off the weapons. And you're like, why are they all so agitated and so mesmerized by this? I'm like, because it's a super organized rhetorical structure that's put together by a lot of money and a lot of smart people. If you want to fight it, you know, just saying we're the good people doesn't do a lot.
Get some money and some smart people together. This is your mission. I agree.
You would think it's not that big a stretch of logic, right? Like, but you've got to get people to understand it's a symbolic.
True that in terms of sheer propaganda, the right has been more effective than the left. And in terms of, you know, just strategic thinking and keeping people rank and file in line and to getting them to the polls, working behind the scenes in certain kinds of ways. So yeah, their truth management skills have been largely superior.
Well, and
since the days of Reagan, if you do the polls, the majority of people have never agreed with the policies of the right. Yet they have been in power for a significant portion of the time.
But they have also not believed in the policies of the left, because what the right's big rhetorical strategy is to just undermine.
Well, they may believe in everything else. You can get them to fear them, right? The fearing progress is the
right.
Yeah.
Well, and basically said, though, that
rhetorical shell is there from Nixon to Reagan to Bush.
All the way back to McCarthyism, right?
I mean, Trump really is not, you know, not very original in most of those basic ways. Most of those things were tried before, just sort of adopted with vehemence, and I think adopted in a kind of a sociologically different, you know, visited in a sociologically different group of people.
Well, anyway. I think you hit on it when you said, like, most people don't believe in the ideas of the right. When you poll America, they tend to believe into the straight on ideals of the left and the ideology of the left. But again, what I think the right has done, and you would not hold this against, an opponent in war, find every weakness, exploit every possible way to win. And what they've done is they've inserted, you know, a space between the ability, like, this is what we want in America, which is all, like you said, we just want to relax, not be afraid of each other and all this other stuff, all the good democratic things. But they've not been allowed to attach that to the Democratic Party. They've inserted, you know, crowbars and pry bars in between those two things so that you can't cleanly believe that that's what that party is going to deliver. So by staining that party, it doesn't matter what people believe in, they just don't believe that party's going to deliver it.
Sure. I think that is, as I look at what's going on, and it is kind of an unspoken truth, because neither side likes that most people are not, don't trust really either party that much. I think there's more people who are independent who are not making decisions on the basis of party. But since the discourse, the organized discourse that you're talking about is made by both parties, they want to make attributions. We won this. This means the Democratic Party is redeemed. We won this. This means the Republican Party. And then they go in and they vote, say, for instance, in the most recent election in Virginia, where Biden won by 10 points there. And how is it that this fellow that we're calling, or some people are calling, a Trump lookalike, now wins by, you know, a significant margin? A huge chunk of the voting public really aren't paying that much attention to party, but that's not an attribution that either party wants to be making. So the part of that is the attempt to brand everything.
Sure, but that's
as the success or failure of their rhetoric.
But that's a perfectly logical thing to do in this kind of modernity environment where everything's overcomplicated, too much information, too much opposing information to ever feel comfortable about a decision. And so everybody retreats back from that to things like what you're talking about. I can't trust this party anymore. Ergo, you know, I'm going to make a decision based on some type of singular isotope that burns brightly enough for me to make a decision about that one thing.
Well, and that's a very flawed set of criteria by and large. What people are reducing it down to their impressions of this character, the character, the moral character of the person. And so we want to say, I voted for the best person. And going into the voting booth is this kind of holy act of self-purification. So the mythological kinds of things going on in why people really do make the decisions that they make, need some work.
Sure. I think, though, like with Biden, it was an interesting thing. You know, Biden had the name recognition, character recognition, hadn't taken that many stains over the years, did not carry like the sort of 40 years of slander or 50 years of slander that Hillary Clinton walked onto the pulpit right, with. Right. And I think that's one of the reasons. And he was a white guy, he was older, establishment, all these things, wore a suit, talked, you know, with gravitas, all the things that you came to expect and we've come to expect in American politics. And so he was a strong enough symbol in some ways that everybody knew what to vote for as a traditional American symbology. But who else has that in the Democratic Party? I don't see anybody coming up behind him that's got that traditional American symbology. Like there was a hit piece of sorts this week in CNN about Kamala Harris, that the VP's in disarray. They're not working with the White House. Like, it was a real hit piece. And I'm like, where did that come from?
Too much from her, really. Yeah.
You know, like they've not done much to say, hey, Biden isn't going to last that much longer. Nobody does at that age. What do we got coming up in the bullpen? They're not doing that kind of work, which again is an infrastructure kind of work that you would expect from a very organized rhetoric machine. It's like, hey, we need 50 guys, 50 politicians that we're constantly bringing up into the American consciousness in case Biden can't do another 4 years or whatever. You can't do that fast. Like in TV, almost all sitcoms.
If you were a baseball team manager, you'd have somebody warming up.
Yeah, right. You'd have really great farm leagues.
Like you'd be scouting some new talent.
The reason why you see the same actors over and over again in TV is that it's really hard to establish a new actor in TV. Yeah. And so once somebody's on a popular sitcom, they can work forever because they bring, you know, sort of built notoriety. And politics, you would think, go back to this idea of let's you and I run the left as rhetoricians. We are now in charge of the machine. I would be like, okay, I need my 50 people. Where are they? And you better need to bolster them constantly for the next 10 years.
Well, I think there is always kind of an eye out for that, and maybe the more shocking thing is how fragile that process is, and I don't think it's just the left. Certainly, that's how you got Trump. Trump stood on a stage with 13 other Republicans. Some of them were probably pretty good guys and with a decent, you know, middle of the road record. A huge chunk of their voting constituency just didn't, you know, had thought that that way of administering, that way of leading had run dry, was impotent. And Trump's particular style captivated the alienation.
I think he was just a super.
It's hard to imagine something. You know, what is the analog on the other side? We had good people standing on. You know, the Democrats had quite a few people standing on stage.
But are they super symbols? Like, go back to the side of that.
Well, but Trump wasn't either. None of those people were super symbols.
Trump was a super
symbol. And Biden really wasn't either.
Yeah, he was. Politically, he was a super symbol. He'd been there enough by a repetition.
The campaign, here's your mediated, the campaign made him that. He didn't start that way. And still to a significant number of Democrats, it was a very dissatisfying thing because he did not energize them with the truth the way that Bernie did. Okay, and they're still bitter about this, right? And that represents a good part of why Biden's popularity has dipped. So yeah, in a time and a place, the decent guy with experience in government, ability not to divide people.
What's his face goes to Washington, right? That was Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, I mean, in contrast to Trump, that worked. Maybe not next time. You know, it depends. That makes a difference. If you look at these primaries and elections, how well people did depends a whole lot on who they're running against. And once again, everybody wants to attribute, oh, we believe Biden. No, we believe Democrats. Oh, we believe Trump. You know, I think once again, the populations are layered with true believers and cynical acceptors. And gosh, I wish there was something better to vote for. And if you spend any time talking, you know, to constituencies, you'll uncover all of those kinds of people. How do you kind of get the campaign is just a way of kind of getting a giant rhetorical lint ball rolling that will pick up all of those things in sufficient numbers to, you know, win the election.
Maybe like I when I look at politics and I think of it, and I pull back again, like I don't ever want to get pulled into the swamp of how politics does politics. I want to look at it as a rhetorician, especially as a modernist, maybe postmodernist rhetorician, which is, sure, can I make this isotope symbol burn brighter than everything else in the room? And if I can, and to me, like Trump was a super symbol. He'd been around for 40 years, had all this affectation, all this visual stuff. It took him a long time before they ever let him into politics. He kept trying for the last 20 years and finally hit the right moment because of social media, let that symbol loose. And it's this super glowing isotope symbol. And if I'm playing rhetorician at the top here and I'm designing this stuff, that's all I'm looking for, because people aren't remembering from day to day what the policies are, or even the scandals or the hits or anything else. They're just, does that symbol continue to burn brighter than everything around it? When Trump was on the stage in the debates, it was ridiculous how much more power he had as a symbol than everybody around him. Like, he just decimated them with the simplest scripts, the simplest insults, because he's just good at delivering reality show, you know, level insults. So to me, like, when I look at this stuff, and again, going back to this idea of what I'd like to see the left be able to do is, like, personally, I'm a fan of nice America. I'd prefer to go back to the relaxed system. So who represents that well enough that people could vote for it? I don't care at all what their policies are. Buttigieg? No, like not yet, at least. Like, he's
not yet, at least.
Symbol. You know, Amy Klobuchar or whatever her name was, Klobuchar? Maybe, but a female never played that role.
Yeah, I think, you know, once again, you've got to have a coalition, and it's, you know, I think she'd be a great candidate. And I think if you just, you know, once again, a certain percentage are going to have a hard time with a Midwestern woman, a certain percentage are going to have a hard time because she doesn't have all the flash or the super progressive agenda. So
So you can deliver an insult.
Once again, we want to invest all of this in charisma, but charisma develops as one, you know, it does barrel along as one achieves a certain degree of success. And so it could happen. It could happen.
I think Stacey Abrams comes in out of the hinterlands of Georgia and just swoops in. I think America can handle like that really superpowered Black woman as a isotope. I think we've seen it enough. I think people are comfortable enough with it. I'd be really curious as to how that works.
Yeah. I think once again, it's the conservative element is going to say, what are you risking? What can have happened? I think it's entirely possible. I think if she hires you as her campaign manager, she has a chance.
So you got to do it too. I can't do this by myself. We need a rhetoric team.
I'm available.
Cadre of retired rhetoricians who are going to help
there
out.
There you go.
Bernie was a holdover symbol from like the Cold War, you know, the old socialist with a lot of Marxist ideas and, you know, very grouchy about it, but he was still a strong symbol. I could at least recognize what the character was, you know, this sort of very Vermont-y, I think it was Vermont, you know, kind of never had much money and yada, yada, yada. So he played the role pretty well. Also, I think too old. I would like to have taken all of his rhetoric and dumped it down onto a 40-year-old and see how people would handle it.
I think you got the right idea. It's an interesting moment. I mean, there's a certain what will be the resistance, you know, to a Black woman at this particular juncture in time? Because there will be some, but
there'll be lots of
those people anyway, right?
But I think she's got like enough power, personal power, and she's got this victory in Georgia. It wasn't just an inspirational victory in Georgia. She didn't win by inspiration. She won by organization, which I think ultimately, like what the right has done, is won by organization. You know, it's nefarious organization. It's breaking the democratic process, but it's still hyper organized, like gerrymandering and taking over school boards up to local, you know, elections. That's highly organized political activity. And sure, I think that's what the left really needs to understand. Like you are, again, you're in a real war here. You know, they are hitting
on
every
cylinder.
She didn't
quite have the national stage the way Kamala Harris does, but she has all of the good things, and then plus, it seems to me.
Yeah, Kamala Harris doesn't have the power center the way that I think somebody like Stacey Abrams does. You know, just that kind of, they've got a legitimate pulpit. There's this huge tradition of, you know, race, fighting for racial equality and racial power now that's part of America. So there's a lot of that to pull from rhetorically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Once again, this is kind of the problem with the progressive agenda. These things are, how does Joe Biden climb to the top, or Hillary Clinton for that matter? I mean, they are institutionalized people. And we notice that Democrats typically err, you know, they regress to that. They run a lot of senators, whereas the track record of senators getting elected is very poor. People don't really want a Washington pro.
Yeah, John Kerry was a great example.
The people coming from the outside is in a way kind of the monomyth. And Republicans don't even, you know, so governors have a much better chance of achieving, you know, getting enough name recognition and at least theoretical experience of an administration to launch. But Democrats can, you know, consistently go for a powerful senator because they believe in government. The other side doesn't believe in government. In fact, believes the government, in fact, taints you. They're constantly looking for an outsider. Look at the background. George Bush, baseball team owner. Ronald Reagan, actor.
Most political family in history, the Bushes. Like he was outside. They positioned him as outside his family, which was, you know, this massive political entity. He's been the guy who's just been drinking and whatever. So, you know, he kind of got the outsider-insider combo.
Even George Sr. didn't come up from the regular ranks. He came up by being connected and But he didn't come up through the standard political ranks. He was head of the CIA. He was, you know, a prominent businessman. He was a lot of things. But so he was a party mover and shaker, but still not, you know, a Washington fixture.
Okay.
So at any rate, I think that's, and I, you know, in a way, because they sort of had offered it, I think, because Stacey Abrams, get her to run for senator, I believe. And she turned that down. And I thought, that's kind of a smart move. It'll save it for later.
Right? I agree. That's what I mean by having a rhetorical strategy, you know, for what you're doing on a national level. When you get somebody like that, that gets that kind of credibility flare up, you know, to take two seats out of Georgia at the last minute in this dramatic, you know, runoff election through organization. That's sure. Pretty, that's a pretty nice punchy little story.
I agree. I think the question is, when is that moment? There's no doubt that that moment is coming. And I've heard you opine before that you think the culture is ripe for the Black woman hero. And I think that's an interesting theory. I do.
She's got to be a real hero.
There are these kind of self-regulating conservative elements that are kind of always want to put a cap on that, that they see risk in that. And it takes prominent people to push it one direction or another direction.
Right. And I think interestingly, like for her, like when you build a hero that can withstand all these forces at the national level, that's the question, right? That's why I was saying Hillary had already been soaked in acid, you know, by years and years and years of this stuff. There was so much, she was such a saturated sure. symbol that she was a flawed.
There are 80
candidate.
Reasons why the small margin of loss could have been attributed.
Yeah, easily. Yeah. Stacey Abrams is new. She had a victory. I don't think, you know, yada, yada, yada. We could look at it, but let's get back to the original idea, which is as rhetoricians, we are just designing this bloodlessly as a symbolic engagement. Like to me, that's the winning stance of rhetoric. And I try to tell everybody this when I have right wingers on, I say, I convert the right and things. I'm like, I don't care what you believe. I care about the process through which we go to get to beliefs. If the process is clean and smart and organized, not overrun with nefarious, unethical tactics, then we'll probably be just fine. So to me, rhetoric gives us that stance of we're doing process here. If you want to get on and do ethical rhetoric, convince me that white supremacy is the way to go for America, or that only, you know, 80% of America has to always be right, white. If you want to make that argument in an ethical way, everybody can look at it, make a decision and move on. The problem is when you move over to unethical tactics and you're like, well, nobody was buying our 80% white. Well, let's go to all the unethical tactics, which is, I think, what the right has done. That whole will to power group, the Tea Party and everything else. It's like we couldn't win with these extreme ideas. But now we've got a distribution system. We've got high production value and we can, you know, use unethical techniques to drive this juggernaut home. But rhetoric can get in the middle of that and go, hey, they're driving a juggernaut. Here's how it's constructed. Here's how to take the tires off.
More power to you.
More power to you. You're a retired rhetorician. You got nothing to do. Come on.
I've had my day. Yes.
You had your day in academics. When did you actually do anything? I'm not impugning you at all because I like rhetoric. I like academics and you know that. But when did you ever do something out in the world with rhetoric? Like I remember once when they were talking about moving the airport and your house was under the, you know, flight path. Famously under the flight path. And you went right. to, I think, some type of community, you know, meeting about it. And you tried to do a little bit of training for these people. And you came back, and you're like, I'm never going to do that again.
I had some brushes with organizational and political consulting along the way. So without going into a lot of details, I did a little bit here and there. And I worked as a grassroots campaigner for a number of candidates, but that's just knocking on doors and making phone calls the way anybody else would.
How insane is that, though? You've got a
really
guy.
Interesting.
Just think about that. You've got a guy who's one of the most trained people on earth, one of the most trained rhetorician humans on earth. and their political activity is knocking on doors.
Well, it's important. It's important.
I'm not saying it's not, but that, you know, a 20, you know, anybody could do that. Nobody can do what you do.
Right. Well, it's interesting because everybody thinks they know a lot, and it boils down to a lot of other things. I just always found it fascinating when I was being trained by college students who had, you know, took the semester off to work for Obama or whatever. So, I found getting involved in those ways really fascinating to see what kind of organization is working there. So those people tend to be chosen on the basis of their loyalty, their energy, and their ability to follow a script. And that doesn't mean there isn't an echelon of really smart political consultants. We see them on the talk shows all the time, right?
Really? Do you find those people smart? I don't particularly find them, again, not within the idea of rhetoric. I don't find them all that sophisticated.
Admittedly, when somebody says I'm a strategist for the Republican, the Democratic Party, I go, what does that mean, right? This is the title of somebody who's just brought there to give an opinion. But yeah, I think the people in the Lincoln Project are by and large pretty smart people.
At a rhetoric level, smart. Are you saying they understand this big game from a strategy point or a theoretical standpoint of rhetoric?
I think they understand, you know, but they also understand politics and votes. But I think there's a huge rhetorical component and sensitivity to that. Sure. I hear a lot of smart analysis of why things did go this way or that way and how people responded. I don't know that I'm smarter than they are. I don't know that my academic education and the, you know, trying to figure out the anthropology of this stuff, why it works, is more important than, you know, the on the ground attention that they've paid to things. So.
Really, you don't think that rhetoric as an architecture, as a software, you know, theoretical set of tools, is stronger than things like political science and journalism and all that?
That's a different question. I'm just, yes, I do think it is. Okay. I think that political science and being an academic discipline misses a whole lot of things. Although there are some political scientists, renegades, who get it about rhetoric. I think by and large, journalism as a pedagogy, as a, you know, institution, largely doesn't get it. But there are some journalists who really are pretty good rhetorical critics. So, yeah, I don't think
now, when you say pretty good, though, let me just stop you just a little on that one. Pretty good. What I typically find, like there was an economist last week or 2 weeks ago who published a thing where he ran a word analysis of congressional political speeches for the last 50 years or whatever. And he showed that over time, race baiting, you know, became more subtle. They changed the terminology, but it's still there. And like in the last 10 years, it's gone up more and more and more and more. And so I'm like, great, quantitative analysis of speeches. Do you know Rod Hart? And I sent him a note. I'm like, hey, have you ever looked at Rod Hart, who was doing this in the 1980s, by the way? And he's like, I never heard of him. Like, what is rhetoric? And he got this published on a national scale. And so I sent it to Hart. And I'm like, hey, Hart, they're pulling up your methodology and nobody knows that you've already done this. To me, like, that is insane that rhetoric has done all this work and it doesn't get harvested.
Well, I think the corollary question is, why, Rod, have you not done this, applied these methods to race baiting, when it clearly is, I think, sort of the engine by which a lot of this identification rhetoric is being fueled these days. But I don't think you need that kind of empirical proof of common sense to have noticed
that
race baiting's been going on.
The fact that this guy, this academic, got this notoriety for this study and everybody's like, oh my God, this is great. Sure. And I'm like, you don't even know you've never even heard of the field of rhetoric. You've never even heard of Rod Hart, who did this 40 years ago. That's insane. That to me is like the rhetoric, my rhetorical agenda for rhetoric is to raise it up so people start using it like the mothership that it is. And if you want to design out, like, hey, if we all said, look, let's set Stacey Abrams up for 2024 or 2028. You know, I like that idea. I would like to see what she would
do. You know, and that's part of what mitigates is how complicated these things really are.
I know. I don't care.
You know, the theory involved is sort of saying, you know, the reason why Rod never counted race baiting was because that wasn't part of his theory of what makes influence happen. He chose a very traditional, you know, almost Aristotelian idea of what things to count that are important. And so, I mean, I certainly could walk you through the ways of thinking about rhetoric that would say, let's look at the way that this is creating sense of identity and division about this group versus that group, and look at the other strategies that have employed this, say, in the last century.
Right.
But then devising a pedagogy so that it sort of alerts people to this, so they aren't going, this is new every time. Oh, my God, let's wring our hands about this and go, well, of course it's happening. I mean, once again, even on the left right now, to not recognize that that this kind of core strategy has basically been ran through every Republican campaign for the last 50 years. But when it comes and it's embodied by Trump, you know, whatever, we just want to vilify it. Say, if we get rid of him, we get rid of the problem.
Right. But they're not looking at the rhetoric. They're looking at the guy saying the rhetoric. I'm like, look at the rhetoric.
So rule number one, and maybe you're already there by saying, well, how do we find this talent and make them, right? It's quit investing everything in the identity of the individual and start looking at, you know, what is the campaign that would win right now? And once again, even the Republicans have kind of stumbled across that one. Shocking to us that this kind of populist, you know, God, what a perfect solution, what a perfect gargoyle it is. We have a populist candidate who's willing to kowtow to the rich and the conservative right. He's neither a fiscal nor moral conservative, yet willing to toss them all the sufficient dog biscuits and really kind of animate them the sort of the frustrated, you know, blue collar male. What an incredible formula. We always seem to kind of discover these things after they happen in some kind of
because process. We're not talking nobody to the rhetorician.
Nobody predicted it. Yeah.
You would know this if like we had used you as a consultant and said, look, it seems like there's a lot of things going on here about race. And you're like, okay, well, here's what identity politics is. Here's the gargoyling identities. Like I wrote a thing the other day on caricatures. Uh-huh. Like the power of caricature in this is one of the reasons why it works on the right. And I wrote a whole list of here's all the caricatures that the right uses. You can't really fight against a caricature. That's part of the problem. It takes things over. It's a cartoon and people understand it very quickly. It's why if you look back in all propaganda during war is that they animalize or dehumanize, they cartoonize the things that we are fighting, the people that we are fighting. And so the fact that the right is now using these tactics within the culture itself, within American society, like instead of turning it on, you know, the Germans or the Russians or whatever, now we're just turning it on the liberals. But it's caricature rhetoric. So how do you counter
the book on groupthink says, you know, it's all laid out there and he's not a rhetorician either. But yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think rhetoricians, we need to get to the table and be
I spent 45 some years trying to educate rhetoricians and them's the teach it. So maybe, you know, that seemed to be the place where we needed the most work.
I totally agree with that. The other problem is,
yeah, and here you are, you know, with the next great solution. The other problem is that you're always, with politics, battling ideology and idealism. And I find this in political conversations. Had they called me up and had they trusted my word and said, gee, can Donald Trump win? I said, absolutely. I've made myself very unpopular representing this point of view with other people.
But you can't play politics and do rhetoric.
And once again, finding, you know, I found, you know, people with PhDs and sophisticated academic knowledge who were saying things like, you know, progressive leftists saying things like, oh, well, I don't see any difference between Clinton and Trump.
Really?
Because that was very much a liberal, or Biden and Trump for that matter. That very much was a liberal, a progressivist point of view. No, you need Bernie. He's really telling the truth.
Well, that massive false equivalence.
With a more radical agenda.
We've said this before. I've said this before, that false equivalency is one of the dominant logical tropes across all politics, and especially, you know, right now. Sure. We're not distinguishing, especially at the smaller levels, of the differences between people or ideologies and things like that.
It's so, you need to disabuse yourself that this is about, you know, your personal vindication or redemption or purification and being right. This is about how do you foster collective action and get enough people, to consent to this. Once again, it seems to be only kind of the pressures of near disaster that seem to be able to get people to do that, right?
Well, you've talked about this before, like when Kenneth Burke, you know, during the Great Depression and stuff, when they actually did pull academics kind of into government, you know, like I guess because it's power sharing, like the politicians, the non-intellectuals have to power share policy and decisions and things like that with an academic entity or an intellectual entity. They don't like to do that.
Sure. Sure.
We get crowded out of the conversation pretty quickly because we're not going for power. We're going for things like truth or accuracy or, you know, background and all this kind of stuff that academics get interested in. But then we don't end up at the table. So we're not influencing the actual good or bad outcomes of these systems. I guess is my point. I'm always like, I would like a rhetorician at the table, maybe talking about Kenneth Burke.
Well, I think that once again, back to what's required in terms of rethinking rhetoric, rethinking it in the modern political context and sociological context, and then sort of, you know, remapping some of the stuff so that we have a way of thinking about what are important questions to ask. So we have a theory of what's important that guides us to ask questions to say, here, count all the different coded ways we do race baiting. Exactly. And once again, when rhetoric is not pristine in this regard, it must draw from, semiotics and linguistics and literature, you know, it must draw, and that is one of its strengths, is its ability to do that, because the realizing those things, those are inroads made by scholars from other areas about how language works. And once again, putting it into this idea of the pragmatic, dynamic, emergent, performed character. Now, this is all comes together in practice. And that's really where that's at. So that's a pretty complicated recipe. I don't know that it's important to have somebody at the table speaking about Kenneth Burke. But somebody who has thought about this in an intellectual environment that has been created by people like Burke and others. And I suppose those people are around there. I think those, you know, some of these people that are on these campaigns were influenced, whether they know it or not, by people thinking in these kinds of ways.
It's it's sort of my thing. I always like, well, I watch Noam Chomsky, you know, and I love listen to that guy. He's so articulate about this stuff, and he's so way far above, you know, the normal dynamic of intellectualism that you get in any kind of media. And he's managed to make it into the media here and there. So it's really interesting to watch him as a character. But the idea that I have this image now of, I don't know if it's kind of like the Boston album cover. You have this massive mothership that is rhetoric, that studies all this stuff, that collects all these different theories so that it can explain whatever it wants to look at. And then you have all the little flying saucers underneath it that are powerful, like politics or semiotics or linguistics, all these kind of things, but they're not the mothership to me, rhetoric is the all-seeing panopticon above it all going, oh yeah, I got it. I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. And it's the one that, again, nobody really knows is there. We don't use it in its sort of puristic form of, hey, let's get a rhetorician in here to really spend some time with this, or a group, and really break this down. So if we want to push race baiting out of the dialogue, out of the public discourse, maybe we have some actual theories and tactics for doing that, as opposed to, oh, this is bad, that race baiting stuff, that's bad.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we still operate in a very literally primitive kind of, you know, you name it and you cast out the demon, rather than realizing we're going to reinvent this under any number of guises. Here it is again. People will find a way to mark the differences that they seem important, and with a little help from, you know, persuaders, can be influenced in that way. So you've got to, you know, maybe you're the guy. Maybe you're the guy. I'm retired.
I got to get more people who.
And here you are. You know, you're using alternative media to provide an educational function. You're not operating through the stale and sterile and decaying halls of academia or the communication field. Maybe that's what you're doing.
Maybe like this, the idea of, and I mentioned this earlier on, like, I think we're in a new rhetorical environment, same way you went from, like you said, orality to writing to, you know, video. And now we're into digital, and this idea that you're in this new environment and nobody's really adjusted to it except for the nefarians. They figured it out very quickly. Hey, there's a lot of new options here, like high production value that people can't really resist, as the symbology is so good, free distribution. We can do so much stuff here, and nobody has really adjusted to it yet.
Look at how far ahead of, you know, using the Facebook bots to echo chamber messages with selected populations. That's a breakthrough in propaganda. That is a tech, you know.
Right.
I was way behind that curve, you know. It had to happen for me to really, oh wow, you know. I certainly wasn't the guy sitting there trying to think, well, here's how I would use that, you know, because who wants to pay attention to that technology?
Well, I remember making this argument with Newman when I first started into cultural studies and sort of anthropology and the traditions of going into primitive tribes and things like that and studying them. And I'm like, this is a great way to teach the capitalists how to come in and kill all these people, you know, and imperialists. Like, you are literally laying it all out for them, so that they know what to go in and do.
Well, that's the problem with knowledge, is that it can be used for good or ill, you know.
And the invasive species of the right that is hacked into the vulnerability code of democracy via all this new technology, again, like, to me, that's what a new rhetorician would look at. It's like, hey, here's what they're doing. It's not that esoteric. Now let's break their machinery or create a matching machinery to compete it, you know, with it, because you can't let them have those sort of advantages rhetorically with distribution or clarity of messaging or hyper-targeting, because you can't really compete against it once they start using those type of technologies. Same way, like the conquistadors.
Once again, pointing this out critically,
right?
Pointing this out critically to whom is going to break the machine. In other words, they set up a machine that all they need to do is to scandalize and terrorize 32% of the population in order to have enough weight. And once again, to insulate that same group against, you know, this is the inoculation effect of this ideology, right? Against any spokesperson and any medium and any countervailing idea. So there's almost no platform from which to say, well, hey, folks, you know, if you read George Orwell, you would realize that we switch off between hating Russia and China. Guess what? We're now saying Russia's our a friend and China's our enemy, and having the 2 minutes hate where you scream at the TV every hour and a half. And that does what for the people who are living in that space. So, you know, 33% don't need this message. 33% can't get this message. Somehow you've got to devise this machine breaking apparatus for that middle group.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why, like on the podcast, I'll bring on the right. And Lunch Club is this platform that lets you do face-to-face conversations with strangers around the world that are both agreed to. You're like, yeah, let's talk. And you can do a little bit of break the inoculation in those situations. And I've run into it over and over again. When I do run into a righty of some sort or a hyper-Christian or whoever, whatever they've been indoctrinated into, I've got enough technique, like I call it nice suasion, you know, sort of using interpersonaling technique to sort of, you know, wheedle my way in and get trusted and then do just light, very light, you know, logic work. But, you know, you feel it come at you with such fire hose force that sort of hyper-scripted over amygdala agitation. And like, okay, that's fine. I'm used to it. It's like being a therapist, like let it go. And then you like let them wear themselves out a little bit. And you're like, hey, I know like you watch a lot of Fox, you know, that's owned by a foreigner. And they're like, what do you mean? Like Rupert Murdoch, he's white, but he's Australian. You know, why are you letting a foreigner tell you what to believe? And just that little mental thorn in there will make them pause a little bit. So you can do a little bit of de-inoculating, you can get through, but you need that technology of Zoom meetings to make it safe enough, lower the agitation and do that kind of communication. So there are, I think, things that the left has not exploited yet to get in there and do that kind of boots on the ground, re-grabbing of the red herd that's been mesmerized by the big technology. But again, this needs to be designed out.
No, I think, you know, once again, you never, you know, there's never a non-rhetorical moment. You've got to spin constantly up until the moment that person walks into the voting booth, because basically there is this swazery realm. And in social parlance, I mean, part of the dysfunction we're experiencing is the lack of social interaction that doesn't occur in these kinds of aligned encampments where messages don't really get through. But in social parlance, you know, I mean, you can, I was reading the other day, we took our RV across the country and people were lovely all of the way. I don't see a divided America.
Did they have a tree flag on that RV?
Most people are willing, you know, face to face to treat each other with some decency, by and large.
Depending, but if they're standing
so once again, everybody's malleable. We're all sibyls with 16 different attitude sets. It's the one that walks into the voting booth and pulls the, you know, punches the card, pulls the lever, whatever the metaphor is these days, that you really have to target here, right? And how to, you know, I think you're, you know, give them enough, you know, ideological cooties that eventually they'll scratch in enough spots and be uncomfortable. And that's about, you know, that's kind of what a political campaign is.
And that's what Trump did to himself for the left, right? They made him such a golem. He made himself such a golem, like his technique of constantly doing conflict, you know, constantly stirring things up, got the left so agitated that they all turned out to vote against him. You know, he was a strong enough symbol for them.
Yeah, at the same time, in a way, that was kind of the winning strategy. Before, I think that's the exact thing is kind of what got him elected in the first place.
Was on the right, he got enough of people. But the first time through, the left wasn't that
scary. Irritating liberals was one of his most redeeming characteristics.
But the left wasn't scared of him the first time. They had not seen him in power. They just thought he was still a clown. I remember writing sometime in 2015, or I think. My daughter or my son asked me about Trump. I'm like, well, he's not going to get elected. And you remember like Obama even said, he's not going to get elected because he was still in clown status. Once he got into power and you could see all the stuff and you start to go, oh my God, he's bringing out the black shirts in Portland with no IDs on them. Like, you know what? I think maybe we'll show up and vote this time because he's moved into the strong authoritarian proof points. He did everything except murder, right? or imprison political opponents, from what I can tell. And that was next. You know, he just got out of power before he got there.
Well, you know, there is this interesting, you know, in the, was it the, it's when Obama got elected, of the Republicans, oh my God, we've got to ask ourselves, for where did we go wrong here, you know? And they concluded that, you know, their messaging was not right. never mind that the ideas were not shared by a majority of people, so the messaging is not right. And so, you know, we continue to do this reevaluation after Hillary was defeated. There was also this kind of, well, wait a minute, what are we not getting across? What do we have to do? And these are your think tanks. They keep coming up with the learn how to speak to Hispanics, which are not a monolithic group of people, as it turns out, despite the simplistic desire that they all behave and vote exactly alike.
So. Yeah. Well, all right. This has been super fun. I knew it would once we started talking about this when we started, because I'm sort of doing this now. In the last month, I've started to actually reach out to people to create, to get some volunteers to help me actually, because I've basically burned all my battery by conceiving this stuff and writing constant content on it. Now I need some volunteer help for people who want to jump in and help me.
Get on the mothership of rhetoric, right?
Exactly.
We will beam you up,
you know,
to an elevated place of understanding.
Well, ultimately, that is my position in the world. Like, I was changed by that education, by being brought into the tribe, sure, of rhetoricians. Sure. And all the people that I grew up with in Kentucky, they are not in that tribe. You know, a lot of good people on the right and the left, it's all fine, but none of them share this kind of terminology and perspective. The rhetoric goggles that you get, you know, that become, you know, part of your brain. So when you look at all these things, you see story, you see character, you see purification, rituals, you can't stop seeing it. And I want the rest of the world to wear these goggles too. So the idea of creating a volunteer force and then turn that into a team and getting funding so we can actually build a really pro, I don't know, I guess like just go back and rescue all the original democracy stuff about public debate and measured claims and all these things which let us do civic kind of, you know, democracy would be nice.
Well,
to have,
like you say,
place.
You know, put out the call, and it could well be that we need a more informal educational system that does not rely upon, you know, the freshman classroom or the sophomore classroom to execute these purposes. And so,
you know, it's funny. I talk to people and they always, again, I've done over 500 of these churn and burn super fast, just meet somebody and start talking things. Right. And they always look at rhetoric because it's the first thing I put on there. I say master rhetorician in my bio. And they're like, how did you say that word? What is that? And then I've got them, you know, I've got them in the right emotional, psychological space. And I'm like, well, it's rhetoric. And
I used to
teach it to 20-year-olds who didn't care. You know, for now, I'm going to try to teach it to adults and make you care, even though it's confusing. So,
there's adult rhetorical education. I love it.
Rhetoric for rhetoric. Well, thanks, man. Super fun. Enjoyed the conversation. We'll get back to success and we'll finish out that packet.
Well, I think once again, you need these Trojan horses maybe the success package is one of them. That these need not to be sort of here, come join the rhetoric mothership, but that they pin themselves on particular kinds of persuasive projects, or maybe in your terminology, useful in certain coliseums, and that it basically the problem is getting people to apply the same. The same understanding, the same structures from one circumstance to the next.
But. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. The thing that gets people hooked the most when I talk to them about rhetoric and the substacks and things that I write is persuasion for parents. Like, I'm going to teach you persuasion skills because essentially my kids are 20-year rhetoric experiments. I raised them very consciously to accept the type of rhetoric I enjoy doing. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah, turns out you can design kids to accept discussion and reason and, you know, things like that, but you have to consciously do it. And so that when you dial all these esoteric mothership concepts down into that tiny little, you know, battle scene of, hey, I got two kids and I'd like them to grow up as decent people, then like people can, you know, see the use of it. Or getting Stacey Abrams president, you know, that's a particular use. All right, man. Well, we'll circle back around. Thanks for jumping on. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We will circle back and keep fixing the world. Get out there and persuade people. They need it.